On Going Deep, we hear stories that help us to go deeper into what sports can tell us about our shared human story. We hear from players and coaches and scholars, economists, reporters, but maybe no other story that we've heard gives us a clear picture about the cost of collegiate revenue sports than the story we're about to hear. This is a story not from last year or a decade ago. This is a story that began 20 years ago, and you'll know this player's name. Football was his great hope for his life. It gave his life purpose and promise, and it almost cost him his life. But by the grace of God and the strength of this man's heart and soul and mind, this is a story of a life rising up out of the ashes to call the sport that he loves to its better angels. Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels. Our guest today on Going Deep is Maurice Clarett. In 2002, Maurice was the freshman sensation of the Ohio State Buckeyes and led them to a national championship. He was kicked out of school after that season, and in 2004, he challenged the NFL rule, trying to enter the draft a year before he was eligible. It wasn't until 2005 that he was eligible to be drafted, and the Denver Broncos picked him in the third round. He didn't make the Denver Broncos, and after that he went to jail. This is the story of Maurice Clarett.
Hello.
Hey, Maurice. This is John and Marcia.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Maurice.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, we're doing all right. So as we listen to Maurice's story, I really want to invite our listeners to have a keen ear to some things that we've talked about several times on Going Deep. Recruiting and the impact of NCAA violations. The cost to players when they cannot capitalize on their name, image, and likeness. That's even aside from the question of a fair wage. And this is a story that is happening before any of that was really on the radar.
Yeah, the thing that strikes me most about Maurice's story is Maurice comes from a hard area in Youngstown, Ohio, a tough place. And here, he was his own advocate.
Mm-hmm.
Maurice called Coach Tressel at Ohio State and said, "You need to offer me." Maurice organized the entire process that he was the first high school football player to leave high school in the middle of his senior year and enroll in college early. I can't tell you how common this is now on college campuses. Maurice was the first one to do it, and he organized it. He was his own advocate. He did it with a team that wasn't even recruiting him, and he called the coach and said, "You need to offer me a scholarship." And when the coach watched the film, he said, "Maurice, you're right, I do."
Right, that's how good he was. And I want our listeners to really actively engage in this story to hear the layers to it. This is not just a story of one person. This is a story of how these systems became more and more entrenched and what it costs people.
Maurice, can you start now? You were living in Youngstown, and you go to a warring Harding High School, which is a pretty big football power. Can you talk a little bit about your senior year in high school and the recruiting process and what led you to Ohio State?
Yeah, well, my mind was made up kind of where I wanted to go initially about my junior year, the beginning of my junior year. And I can kind of give like a history lesson on here. Urban Meyer at the time was the like the offensive line coach or the wide receivers coach, I'm not sure, over at Notre Dame. And I was initially slotted to go to Notre Dame. And this was prior to Coach Trussell coming to Ohio State. This was like the year 2000, 2001. And I went to Notre Dame and I met Urban Meyer and Rex Hogan. And in the process of being there, I remember talking to them both and saying, hey, man, you know, I just had a great, or I was getting ready to have a junior year. I was getting ready to go into my junior year, I believe. And I just had a great sophomore season, getting ready to go into my junior year. And in the process of that, I was so anxious to get away from high school and just away from my neighborhood. I said, hey, man, you know, I wish there was a way that I can graduate early. And actually, Rex Hogan, with this whole graduating early trend that you see going on in the country, a guy by the name of Rex Hogan, who used to work with the Jets and also Notre Dame, he was the guy that initially crafted the plan for me to graduate early to come to Notre Dame. But in the process of me crafting that plan and doing it, Bob Davey had got let go at Notre Dame, and Urban Meyer ended up going to Bowling Green. And subsequently, Jim Trussell was down at Ohio State. And with me being a kid from Youngstown, Ohio, and watching Jim Trussell for so many years, my attraction was just want to play for him just because I knew the social impact that he had at Youngstown State. And what actually happened was that I called Jim Trussell up, and I said, hey, Coach Trussell, you know, I would like to come to Ohio State. You all haven't offered me a scholarship, but, you know, after my senior season, you would. And lo and behold, you know, he kind of laughed and joked. But I said, after this year, you all would probably want to offer me. I was a lot more arrogant then. And the next thing you know, I went out and had a successful senior season. I kind of picked the school. The school didn't pick me, but I had, you know, every offer from, you know, every school that you could possibly name, from Miami to Tennessee to Notre Dame. To, you know, Arizona State, you know, to Maryland, to Indiana, and to, you know, Penn State and Michigan, anybody that you can possibly think of at the time.
What was it specifically about Jim Trussell that was attractive to you?
I think it was simple. You know, Youngstown was filled with a bunch of violence, and it was like a rough city growing up. You know, you knew that. I didn't have to compare it to another city to know that it was a rough upbringing. And some of the guys who had played for Coach Trussell were guys just from our neighborhood or from our city. And the guys looked like me. It looked like these guys were from the neighborhood. And for whatever reason, they had a tremendous amount of respect for him. And you just kind of see, like, you know, all the community service stuff that they had done, the camps that they had done about in town. And it was, like, very apparent that Coach Trussell cared about young black kids. And I think that there's something that you can't put your finger on when you're younger. And I think there's a basic feeling, but you can understand that, you know, just from a racial standpoint, that if somebody cares for you or not, or if you're just a black kid being coached by a white coach, there's that dynamic. There's also another dynamic that, you know, this guy in front of me doesn't see color. This guy in front of me really cares about me. And I think Coach Trussell, through all that he did throughout the community and just, you know, things that he had done in general, I think that he conveyed that very well.
Hmm. So you use the word arrogant, but I'm listening to you and it sounds like you were actually pretty sophisticated in the way you were thinking through things as a high school student. Like you were your own advocate. You were thinking in terms of like, how can I really, whatever my next step is, how can it be something that really is life changing for me? I mean, that sounds pretty mature for a 16, 17 year old.
Yeah, no, I guess, like, you know, arrogant in my abilities, you know, you can call it arrogance, you can call it confidence, but I think anybody you see who plays at a high level. I think there's a tinge of craziness and a tinge of arrogance that you have to have in order to just, you know, consistently psych yourself up. And I was able to tap into that, you know, at an early age, and just to be able to just have a supreme amount of belief in myself. And you know, I used to model myself after Mike Tyson. If you could say anybody, like, who did I pattern myself after, I would see Mike Tyson do interviews, and I would see Mike Tyson fight. And, you know, between him and Walter Payton, I used to think that, you know, I was a combination of both of those guys. And if you ever see how I ran, if you see those two people rather fight or run the football, you can kind of see a mixture of both.
I followed your career at Ohio State, and one reason that I did was I was the offensive coordinator of the Chicago Bears when you went to Ohio State, and Coach Tressel stole our tight ends coach, old Coach Jim Bowman, to go with him to Ohio State. And so I followed everything that was happening at Ohio State because Jim was such a good friend of mine. And early in Coach Tressel's career, obviously you guys got so good so fast. In your freshman year in 2002, when did you realize, son of a gun, our team is pretty good, but more as important, I'm pretty good, and this starting position is going to be mine. When did you realize, when did things start to change for you in that freshman year? We see freshmen have success a lot nowadays because they come in early, as you said, and that's quite common. But you didn't go to Ohio State earlier, did you?
Yeah, I was the first guy that ever did it.
So you did that at Ohio State as well. You went to Ohio State mid-year, and then you when did you become the starting tailback? In that spring or in the fall?
No, in the fall, 2 weeks before the season. So I came in, and I just had a broken thumb. And so I had a cast on my hand all throughout spring ball. And so it kind of limited me to some stuff that I can do with carrying the ball in my left hand and catching the ball and so on and so forth. But from a competitive standpoint, I just knew the way I competed or the way I thought about competing was completely different than my peers. You know, we just weren't playing from the same space, and I was pretty apparent, you know. And, you know, now dealing with the mental health aspect of things so much, I started to understand that I was playing from a place of deep trauma, you know, and understanding all of what I experienced coming up. You know, I was just playing from a totally different place than the guys who were competing for the same job as mine. And it actually was during the fall camp that I knew that I was better than these guys, but I just didn't have the opportunity. And so one thing that I did to combat that, I understood early on that, you know, outside of your first two groups of people, your first string, your second string, the third or fourth string guys really don't get that many reps against the scout team defense. And then I was like, okay, I need a way to like circumvent this. So I went on the practice squad on purpose, and I was taking reps actually from our scout team players. And I knew that in order for me to get looks, I would have to compete against the first team defense. And I told myself, right, if I do good against these guys at practice with, you know, the third and fourth string line, that I could start to get looked at. And that's where some of my success started to happen. Mm-hmm. And really that's where my confidence started to come because, you know, I didn't have a choice but to, like, run at guys, or I got kind of, like, the worst looks, you know, be it that I had, you know, one of the, you know, guys who were third or fourth string. And what ended up happening was that we were running a goal line drill 2 weeks before the season. And 2 weeks before the season, I remember that Coach Tressel, he called us up and he said, you know, we're about to do goal line offense and, you know, against the first team defense because we were getting ready to prepare for Texas Tech. And the first guy came in, he started fumbling the ball as he was getting hit. The second guy came in, he acted like he had twisted his ankle because, you know, he had the number one defense. And guys were, you know that preseason, guys were ready to get going, they cranking each other. And, you know, the second guy just didn't want to get hit the way he did. And then, you know, Coach Tressel was getting frustrated. And at that time, Coach D'Antonio, who's the coach up at Michigan State right now, he was like, hey, man, I need a better look. And Coach Trussell finally gave me the opportunity with the first team offense. And I had been playing with these guys as a scout team player for so long that I wasn't scared of them. And I was just running at guys and giving them the best look. And it was actually Coach Dino, Coach D'Antonio, who called Coach Trussell and said, hey, man, we need to stick him in there more because he gives us the best look out of all the running backs. And then I ended up having success, and I earned the spot, you know, 2 weeks before the season. I went from fourth string to first string in a matter of a day, in a day's practice.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Again, like, there seems like there was – you use the word trauma, but there were things in your kind of in your psyche and your experience that made you really driven, made you really determined. You had a goal in mind, and you strategized about how to make it happen. But there was also a kind of maturity there that, like, you made some good choices, and you took some risks where it was a good risk to take.
You know, a scout once told me when I was in the NFL, he said, I like players that play as if there's no plan B. I have to make it. You know, if I don't make it, there's no plan B. In the intensity that you talk about in approaching that, of, hey, I'll go with the fourth string offensive line against the first team defense just to show them what I could do. Your intensity strikes me as, hey, there was no plan B. You were going to make it.
You know, it's a lot. You know, when you come in from, it doesn't matter if you're a poor white kid, poor black kid, poor Hispanic kid. If you're coming from an environment, you know, most kids are just trying to escape these environments that they grow up in, you know, and if some people's circumstances are better or some people's circumstances are better than others. But, you know, when you experience, you know, I can just remember, you know, growing up and the amount of murders and violent crimes that you have seen firsthand, you know, that stuff traumatizes the kid when you're scared to be at home. You hear gunshots all the time. You see people getting killed. You see people getting robbed, and then you start to participate in crime yourself. Then you start to realize that if I don't make better decisions, this could be my life. You know, that's a great driver. It's not driven to be great. It's like, I want to get out of this environment. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And oftentimes, the vehicle that you only see that's worthwhile is this football vehicle or basketball or entertainment or something that you easily understand that you can, you know, enjoy doing to get out of that environment.
Right.
And that was the same thing with me, you know. And like I said, I'm an adult. I'm 35 right now, but I can remember my childhood vividly to the point where I can remember, this is almost like a month ago, waking up, I would call it PTSD, where you're like, man, you start to think about your neighborhood, how you came up, and you wake up in a cold sweat. And you're like, man, I can't believe I actually survived that stuff.
And that's so important what you're describing right there. And I think people don't always get that understanding of what so many kids that, you know, come from environments like you're describing, and then they see football or basketball as their path out. So they're willing to do whatever it takes. They're willing to deal with the injustices of the situation. They're willing to, you know, do things that they know are not probably right or good that the coaches are telling them to do because they are good soldiers. They just want to make it. This is their path out. And that's a narrative that their families support. That's a narrative that they've known their whole lives. And I think that's a really important thing for people to understand in the broader picture of why revenue sports, especially for young men of color, is really, it's not just a game. It's life and death. It's how your life has a chance to take a turn. There's an urgency there. There's something there that is really important for people to hear in the larger context of why these justice issues are important. Beyond just, oh, well, they're football players. What's the big deal? It's just a game. No, it's not just a game.
It's really, and I think people are skewed a lot because the money that's involved. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's a, I think there's a underlying or underpinning of jealousy with the amount of money that these guys can make or that they generate. And you know, that's a whole, you know, that's a whole conversation that we could probably spend 2 hours on within itself. But, you know, I wanted to share a thought even while you were talking about that, something that came up in my mind. I remember, you know, when I went through this stuff of, you know, basically being pushed through school and letting sports be like the most significant thing going on in my life and thinking it was like ultra important. And I can remember about all the people who had assisted me and kind of helped me to basically get to the point where I was. And I remember looking back on it, I used to say to myself, like, being coaches and teachers or people who are involved, like, there's a bit of, there's an indifferent feeling. And the indifferent feeling comes from, I didn't know if these people were enablers or if they were realists who understood that this may be my only chance to get out of this environment. So we'll do whatever we have to do and able to assist him in getting out. And, you know, I go back and look at some of the classes that I was putting in. I go back and look at some of the work that I had done. And, you know, and I say, hey, maybe if I was pushed harder, would I even be at this point that I'm at right now? Or if I would have pushed harder, would I have given up and just walked out? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And those are the things I don't know because, you know, I look at some of the coaches and these guys weren't bad guys and they weren't just trying to use me. But I also, you know, it's a thing you feel indifferent about. I'm not sure that you can have that open conversation with many people, you know what I'm saying? Because
yes.
It's a very unpopular conversation, but it's a real conversation that goes on, but nobody wants to have it.
Your freshman year, you have... you're a huge success, rush for over 1,200 yards, 18 touchdowns. Ohio State wins the national championship. And then from there, well, you end up leaving Ohio State. Can you walk us through what happened how you ended up leaving Ohio State and then ultimately challenging the NFL draft?
Yeah, so I never wanted to leave Ohio State. Let me just, you know, make that very clear. I never wanted to leave. I planned to, you know, the NCAA has suspended me indefinitely. And, like, my plan was to sit out that entire season, come back the next year, take my lumps, take my bumps, but go play my junior year, and after my junior year, eventually go to the NFL.
And why did the NCAA suspend you, if you could tell us that?
I probably had, you know, maybe 120 violations. And the violations were they were magnified, right? So I give you an example. One violation was like turned into 30 or 40 violations, and actually I had a cell phone my junior year in high school, right? I give you an example, and from having the cell phone in my junior year in high school, that I was paid for by a booster. Every month that the booster had paid my bill, that constituted as a violation.
Oh,
so
gosh.
The booster had paid for my cell phone about like 36 times. Let's say 36 times or 25 times, whatever it may have been. And when it was reported to the NCAA, it was like, okay, yes, 25 violations.
Jeez,
right?
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, and there was duplicate stuff like that. Instead of saying, hey, you know, he had a cell phone where somebody paid for him since his junior year with a cell phone. The totality of the bill was probably, you know, $1,500 maybe, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was said differently, like, hey, he's violated 125 violations, you know, which sounds a bit harsh.
Sure.
And sounds like I'm just running rampant and taking gifts from every booster, which was not the truth. You know, then you had another violation where, or another situation where, I went to go to a car dealership to use a car because my transmission had basically blown. And in the process of doing this, you know, I went to the car dealership and the guy said, hey, Maurice, you can go ahead and use the car. So I was using a rental vehicle or a vehicle from the car dealership. And every day that I had the car, that constituted as a violation. You know, and I had a car for like 30 or 40 days. You know what I'm saying?
So that's 30 or 40 violations, and you're looking at 150 instead of just two, the phone and the car.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes. And so it sounds a lot worse than what it is. And, you know, all this stuff is public information, these transcripts, these tapes, all this stuff is, you know, people can go back and look at it. Yeah, somebody who was like that interested in doing so. And when you all look back at it, you know, we're talking about this stuff totals less than $3,000 or $4,000. You know, this stuff is like peanuts, you know, when you talk about the rental of a car and you're talking about a cell phone and so on and so forth. So it's
not to mention the dynamic of a kid that came from the environment that you did, needs a phone, needs a car. Like, these are basic things, and not, kind of criminalizing that is part of the problem.
And not to mention, yeah, you just led the team to a national championship and probably made $1 million for every coach.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to state the reality of it. You know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to minimize what I did. I'm not trying to act like when I did what I did, I didn't know it was wrong. But, you know, oftentimes when we talk about this, people believe, like, you know, I took like $100,000. You know what I'm saying? And it's not nowhere near the case. I just had to put stuff in perspective for people to be like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, right. This is a bit excessive for what we're talking about, right?
Well, I think that's interesting, and you really did put into perspective something that I've told administrators, boosters, politicians, anybody that would listen for years, that the things I'm talking about the players need include things like money for a cell phone, transportation to and from their home. The players that I loved and cared for, nobody was asking me for plane rides to Los Angeles or, you know, extravagant trips on cruises. They were asking me for gas money.
Food.
To help keep the electricity on at their mother or father's apartment. And that's what people don't realize. If you were to say to someone, this guy that just led us to the national championship needs a cell phone. Well, that sounds a lot different than 120 improper benefits, you know, accumulated over a year. And
it sounds completely different.
Yeah. One of the things that really boggles my mind is that Maurice is kicked out of Ohio State and really has committed two violations. And if you read about Maurice Clarett, it'll talk about hundreds of violations. There's really two things that happened. A booster gave Maurice a cell phone so that the coaches could recruit Maurice. Maurice didn't ask for a cell phone. The booster gave it to him so the coaches could recruit him. That's one violation, yet every bill that was paid by that booster on that cell phone constituted another violation. And when Maurice was in Columbus, he took his car to the garage to get the transmission fixed. He didn't ask for a rental car. The guy at the car place gave him a rental car and said, use it until we get this fixed. And every hour or every day that thing was
used,
every day that he had the car constituted another NCAA violation. And Maurice said, I didn't ask for the car. The guy just said, here, you can use this car while we're fixing your transmission. I think those are things that are interesting to me, that had Maurice just had a little bit of spending money, had just had a little bit of change in his pocket, those violations never would have occurred. He'd have gotten his car taken care of, and he'd have paid for his own cell phone.
So there's so much more to this story. And in the next episode, we're going to hear how these seemingly ridiculous violations, a cell phone, a rental car, really folded into a near tragedy. I mean, this could have cost Maurice his life. In episode 2 of our conversation with Maurice, I challenge anybody to not be inspired by the way this man navigated so much pain, so much disappointment, and really so much dereliction of duty by the adults in his life that said they cared about him. It is an inspiring story, and I hope you'll join us on the next episode. You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.